Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Sipping beer, they catch up on the events of the week. Tilly and Millie thawed blueberries and baked 15 blueberry pies for their church bazaar. Mabel canned a dozen quarts of venison stew and a half dozen pints of partridge. She uses lemon rind with the venison, plus carrots, onions, and potatoes, and bay leaf in both the stews. And Fawn is nearly done with her fall weaving for a shop down in Thunder Bay. Greta tells about her swan stained glass window, while thinking it would be nice to make small stained glass window hangings for all of her sauna friends this year. Though she knows there isn't enough time, she would have had to have started last summer, in August at the latest. Tonight, resting quietly in front of the fire in stockinged feet before the men return from the sauna, the women are content, relaxed from the steam and the beer, and another simple, productive week. Greta feels at ease for the first time all week, and is thinking of telling them how Gabriel has been visiting her from beyond the grave. Mabel often speaks of her weekly visit to the town cemetery to talk things over with her beloved Johnny. But then she hears the sauna door slam and decides maybe next week, if Gabriel isn't gone by then. And besides, she could use more time. The men are talking quietly as they enter the lodge, their faces red and shiny from the sauna. They open their beers at the bar, except Otto, who no longer drinks and settles for a root beer. At 9 o'clock, the bird in the cuckoo clock begins to count out the hours, and they are all settled in their chairs by the time the crooked little man with the cane and the bent woman with a cat in a basket come out from the wooden clock door and move jerkily around to a second door, which closes neatly behind them. In the summer, Latos plays the piano on sauna nights, but hardly ever in winter, except at Christmas. He says his hands get too cold and stiff in winter weather, so they sit and drink and talk a little, not much, unless someone has a story. Mainly they sit and look at the fire, which crackles and flickers its light over the gold logs of the lodge room and over the bear and timber wolf skins tacked to the walls. At 9:30, though, later in summer, Latos plugs in the jukebox and plays a song to end the evening. Usually the Tennessee Waltz, but sometimes What'll I Do? Or a Swedish waltz that's been on the jukebox ever since Greta started coming to the sauna evenings. It was Fawn who first invited her. The rest of the songs on the jukebox are current popular songs left over from the previous summer when the lodge is open for dinner till 8 o'clock and the bar stays open until 11 on weekends. On the way to the car, they pass Leto's husky team in their kennel. A few of the dogs are awake and pace back and forth. Shadow, who is half wolf and half Siberian husky and the only pup to survive from last spring's litter, stops to watch us as they pass by. He has one blue eye and one yellow-brown eye, a white masked face, and a heavy black body with a wolf's lanky legs. Last week, Shadow followed Fawn and Greta down to their cars and nudged Greta hard. She had nearly fallen in her rush to get away from the dog and into her car, though she's known Shadow since he was a few weeks old. He was one of the pups Latos let wander around, and he still roams around on his own most of the time, as he did last week. Greta finds herself wondering if Latos keeps Shadow in the pen with the others during a full moon, and is surprised at the spooky feeling she has tonight. She's never paid much attention to Shadow before this past week anyway. In winter, the dogs take on a wildness you don't notice so much in summer, which makes her wonder just how wild they really are, just what they might do, and particularly Shadow. When Fawn says his eyes are half-wolf and half-human, Greta is silent, but she thinks about Shadow as she drives home that night. Chapter 3. Gabriel in Canada. The telephone rings as Gabriel pulls an Icelandic jacket over his head. He lets the door slam behind him as he strides down the snowy backyard path to the orchard. He pauses to look at the raspberry patch where the tallest canes poke out of a snowdrift, and he makes a mental note to thaw some berries from the freezer for later. This year was his best crop, and many days he sat out under the apple trees eating a big bowl of berries with thick cream, so sweet, so delicious. A few frozen berries in the snow catch his attention. They're red, startling against the fresh white snow, and somehow disturbing, yet beautiful too. He feels the bird feeder in the orchard, then sits for a moment on the old wooden bench where it faces the winter sun. When he can't get to the lake, this is where he comes, to his trees, his orchard. 6 Canadian Macintoshes, 3 Wealthies, 2 Northern Spy, and 1 struggling Golden Delicious. Here in the orchard, he feels at home and happy, almost happy. A few apples still hang in the highest branches. He counts 10, then watches a crow land on the back fence. The phone ringing in the distance breaks his meditation. The same caller? He gets up abruptly and heads toward the house, aware that he is walking out of a winter scene like one might step right out of a painting, leaving behind a bare spot in the landscape. The migraine he tried to shake in the orchard creeps back into his brow like a heavy, numbing slug, yet he laughs and stretches his arms in the crisp winter air toward the sky. Gabriel sits in Dr. Sonier's waiting room and leafs through a travel magazine. He studies a photo of a couple drinking wine on a picturesque balcony in Tuscany. He knows the wine on their table from its label, and he recognizes the model, Nicole, from his days with the Paris Ballet. For a time, she was the girlfriend of a friend, and he wasn't very fond of her, though he loved to watch her walk. She walked like an African woman balancing a jug of water on her head, erect, elegant, a female cat. She was French Haitian. She was gorgeous. "Gabriel, how are you?" Dr. Sonier asks warmly, welcoming him to his acupuncture session. After a lifetime of tortuous migraines, Gabriel is grateful to begin a second week without pain. Dr. Sonier's needles have given him the relief he never thought possible. And he doesn't mind the odd side effects, such as last Wednesday, when he was so energized after Dr. Sonier worked on his neck that he couldn't sleep for 3 days. It felt no fatigue whatsoever. Living without the migraines makes him feel like a new person, which indeed he really believes he is. He shaved his beard of 5 years and has an optimism he hasn't had for years. Funny, when he shaved his beard, as he rinsed out the sink, he thought of Greta. She was the one who told him to grow a beard. She said, "People will tell you their secrets if you grow a beard." And he had laughed naturally. Ballet dancers never have beards. Odd how she knew, though. She was barely 16. He was 18. So the beard was a very deliberate act on his part, marking his transition from performer to teacher at the age of 23. He still has daydreams about Greta, and sometimes he dreams of her at night. After she left, he could never find her. He was in Europe when she got out of the hospital. She had injured her knee in an unlucky fall on icy stairs after an early storm, an ugly twist to her right knee. When he returned, she was gone, and that was the last he heard of her, zapped as if into thin air. But he knew she must be somewhere, somewhere in Canada's vast white expanse of ice and snow. Frozen alive, sometimes he thought that when he had bad dreams. So many lost, frozen souls in Canada, his dancing home, the land of frozen calves and thighs and legs of glass. In Italy, Gabriel had actually started to thaw. He was limber. He went to discos. His migraines were less frequent, though more severe, or he might still be there. Now, lying on his stomach on the acupuncture table, listening to Dr. Sanier's water fountain, those summertime days with Greta seem as distant as a dream, but pleasant to remember while he's stretched out like this. He can almost hear the water bubbling along in the stream they used to follow, behind the school on the way to the park. And the birds. He loved the birds chattering as they strolled along the path beside the river. It wasn't exactly strolling, but more like they were walking and floating at the same time, moving along like some sort of watery birds. Sometimes he and Greta held hands when Violet wasn't along. Violet joined them occasionally, and he didn't mind, because Greta seemed more at ease with the three of them, at least at first. Later they would leave before Violet could join them, walking quickly away from the school. Then they got into the habit of having picnics in the park. Greta made sandwiches of radishes or cottage cheese and cucumbers, sometimes Swiss cheese on rye. She was inventive. And apples. He brought the apples. And he kept wanting to kiss Greta, especially after the apples. He always wanted to, but she seemed so young. Was he waiting for her to grow up? Had he wanted her to remain innocent a while longer? And then, when he was sure they were both ready, the first snow fell and ended the privacy of the picnics, plus new rehearsal schedules, and his travels limited their time together. He sighs and wiggles his toes. He knows Dr. Senyer is nearly finished because he has the Lilliputian sensation he gets toward the end. He feels big and loose and weightless, as if he could float in space if the table were slipped out from under him. Comfortable within his body and with his closed eyes, he thinks of ancestral wings resting lightly on his shoulder blades. Before he gets up, Dr. Senyer moves him near the sink and pours the warm, scented oil over his forehead. The oil smells like forests and exotic gardens. This anointing with oil is his favorite part, though Dr. Senyer tells him it's not traditional to acupuncture, but he likes to incorporate various Eastern procedures for his patients, as needed, and they all seem to enjoy the scented oil. His assistant, Trina, washes Gabriel's hair in tea tree oil shampoo, and as she rinses his hair, with his eyes closed, he thinks of himself under a warm tropical waterfall. She dries his hair and combs it into place, and aware of Trina's smile floating around the room under the cloud of her hair, he slips on his coat and drifts out of the office with his next appointment card in his hand. Chapter 4. Fawn and Greta are on their way to Thunder Bay. Greta has a box of stained glass work in the fleece-lined trunk of Fawn's Ford, and Fauna's recent weavings are piled loosely on the back seat. They plan to drop off their work at the craft cooperative near the knitting shop and then have lunch. It started snowing around dawn, just after they left the lake, and has been snowing lightly all morning. Fawn's car is white, so looking out the window, they see only the bright white of the Canadian winter. Fawn is driving, and Greta keeps dozing off. She hasn't been sleeping well. When she is awake, she watches the road, pictures herself and Fawn as little figurines in a glass paperweight snow scene. But the snow never settles to the bottom. It just keeps snowing and snowing. The night of the last sauna, she dreamed of animals, of the wolf and bear skins on the walls of the lodge, swelling up and filling their empty skins, so that the entire wall seemed alive. There were too many eyes, and the mouths moved like centipedes made of teeth. Every night since, she has had a nightmare she can't remember during the day, but she wakes suddenly afterward and knows it was a nightmare, and her nightgown is soaked with sweat. Last night, she thought she saw eyes on the other side of the frosty window of her bedroom before she fell asleep, and again when she awoke in the middle of the night. She plans to look for sleeping pills in Thunder Bay. The snow continues to fall, and it remains just bright enough to see a slight shadow at the edge of the road, indicating the ditch. Fawn says it's more like flying an airplane in the clouds than driving a car on a road. It's dreamlike, isn't it? Fawn says, partly to see if Greta is awake. I wish I had such dreams, she says. I've been having bad dreams lately. Fawn looks over at Greta, who looks sad, and doesn't elaborate, so she drives on in silence. Several miles later, Greta tells Fawn that she has always loved the snow, that she and her friends used to make snow angels on a winter night, then just lie there in the snow looking up at the stars, cozy in their snow suits and thick woolen mittens. She remembers the feel of lint against her tongue from the wool scarf and how warm her scarf was, even though it was wet from her breath. They were just kids and naturally high on the simple wonders of the world. I'd like to die like that, Greta says. You scare me today, Fawn says, startled at Greta's comment. But Greta laughs and tells her she's thinking of the perfection of those winter nights, lying in the snow. Oh, come on now, surely you've had moments so perfect you could happily die in them, too. No, she asks Fawn. Feeling better about Greta's state of mind, she leans back and thinks while she drives along. A perfect meal once. A pheasant and wild rice, cornbread and honey, with caramel custard with raspberry sauce for dessert. And afterward, sitting in the car watching the stars, with Mitchell, the year before we married, she says. Yes, I could have died that night, gone out like a falling star. They both laugh. They stop to change positions. Greta maneuvers over the emergency brake to the driver's seat, and Fawn, who is wearing good boots, runs around the car to the passenger side. Fawn won't sleep, but she will rest. She would rather be driving. She trusts her own driving. She concentrates on the snow in the road, as if that will help keep them from going into the ditch. She knows she won't give up her stare at the road vigil until they get to Thunder Bay, some 30 kilometers ahead. She has done this before, though this is the first time she's made the trip with Greta. Flakes of snow, a million flakes, so white, so sparkly, like a great outdoor moving picture screen of glittering white sky. If I watch attentively, coming straight at me, Gabriel? The car swerves to the right. Greta grips the wheel, steering straight as the car slides along the far edge of the road, bumping against a crusty shoulder and swerving back onto the road. She stops. No, you're in the center of the road, Fawn shouts in a state of alarm. She hears a car or a truck, and it's quite loud. Greta looks plainly out of her mind, her eyes blank and staring straight ahead. Fawn gets out and sees the lights of a snowplow, some 200 yards behind them. She wastes no time getting in the driver's side, tries to push Greta over, then half sits on Greta's thigh. And with the car door open and big wet flakes of snow hitting her in the face, she pulls the car to the side of the road, or at least out of its center, and stops the car. Greta tumbles to the passenger seat, and Fawn flicks on the emergency light, then leans back against the car seat with a great sigh. The plow pulls over in front of them, and the driver steps down from the cab. Fawn opens the window, even though the car door is still ajar. Engine trouble? He asks, peering over his fogged-up glasses. He looks a bit frail for a truck driver, Fawn thinks. No, just the damn snow, Fawn tells him. Gets to you, doesn't it? He says, looking at them. Your friend okay? Fine, just a little shaken, Fawn says. Stay behind me, you'll be all right. He leans down close. Don't lose me, eh? No more than 30-40 feet behind, but don't get too close, in case I slide. He walks back to the plow without waiting for an answer, assuming they'll have enough sense to follow his path and his guiding light in the near, now, white-out conditions. Fawn gently shakes Greta by the shoulder. Greta? Greta shakes her head and sinks back into the passenger seat. It's okay, Fawn tells her. You get hypnotized. The snow coming down mile like that after mile. Fawn pulls out and catches up with the snowplow, lining up the front of the car with the blinking orange plow lights. They follow the slow yellow light of the plow without passing another car coming or going the entire 20 kilometers into Thunder Bay. The plow honks as it turns in at a truck stop at the north edge of town. They toot back, but continue down Center Street. The craft store is closed, but the coffee shop next door is still open. The wind howls and a whirl of snow spins inside as they close the door of the cafe. A man in overalls is eating mashed potatoes and meatloaf at one of the tables, and Dorothy looks up from her newspaper. Well, Fawn Lake, of all people, she says, setting down the paper. You're down here on a day like this? She comes around the counter and gives Fawn a friendly hug, and Fawn introduces Greta. And this here's Ernie. She fans back her hand toward the man with the mashed potatoes, who nods back and touches his hand to the tip of an invisible hat brim. "Now you take a table back here," she tells them, "away from the door." Fawn and Greta leave their coats at the table, head for the restroom, and Dorothy gives Ernie a refill of coffee. When the women return, Dorothy has steaming hot coffee waiting for them, plus real cream in a pitcher, so they won't have to use the fake packets of creamer set out on each table. Dorothy is on the phone behind the counter. "Dorothy makes crocheted toilet paper holders," Fawn says. "No, really, don't laugh. She's very talented. They're like old-fashioned doilies, made very tight at the bottom, and she makes either white ones or ones that look like fruit strawberries or purple grapes, usually. You'll see some tomorrow at the shop. She used to have them in the restrooms here, but someone stole one once, so she doesn't keep any back there now. Tourists, probably." "I didn't mean to laugh. It just sounds funny. I wish I could crochet, but I can't do it. I can't keep the holes even. I wanted to make curtains for the bedroom windows in my cabin," Greta says. "What'll you have?" Dorothy says, coming over with an order pad. "You must be starved, coming all this way in a storm. Try the soup and pie. Chicken vegetable with dumplings. My dumplings. Ernie finished off the mashed potatoes. He sure likes his mashed potatoes," she says, glancing over at Ernie. "The pie is raspberry, made from fresh frozen berries from Jensen's farm." "Sounds perfect," Fawn says. "Same for me," Greta says. "Dorothy's pies are worth going through storms for," Fawn tells Greta. "Ha, you guys," Dorothy says, laughing as she goes off to get the soup. "You have to wait a sec for the dumplings," she tells them over her shoulder. "I make them fresh." "I really need this normal place and a bowl of normal soup," Greta says, shaking her head. "How do you tell if you're going crazy?" she asks, not sure if she's asking seriously. "I think you lose your sense of humor. You have nothing to worry about. It's just the snow, all that snow coming at you. You're all right," Fawn says. "I hope so," she answers, but she's scared. She saw Gabriel on the road in the snow, floating above the road in the snow. Chapter 5. Beginnings. Gabriel is dancing in the second floor studio. From across the street, Greta watches him leap across the room of many windows, his form concealed behind the brick, then revealed at the next window. He dances from window to window as if he is within the frames of a film strip. The first floor door is open. She climbs the stairs halfway and stops. She can hear the thumping of Gabriel's feet as he dances on the wooden floor and the thud of each hard landing. The sound of dancing human feet always surprises her. She stands for 5 minutes, maybe longer, waiting for courage to go up. Should she? Dare she? He may be angry. Will he remember her? Will she be interrupting? The door to the studio is open. She leans against its frame and watches him dance, forgetting herself, seeing only the dance, his leaps above the great oak floor. He spins through the sunlight of the windows. She is aware of nothing else, just the dance, until he lands with a leap in front of her, breathless. Gabriel takes her hand and pulls her into the room. He helps her with her slippers. Her fingers tremble as he tightens her laces. That night, when she was trying to fall asleep, she was still in a state of glory. She couldn't come down to earth. How could she tell anyone what it was like? Dancing with Gabriel wasn't anything she could explain. She could as soon call her mother on the phone and tell her she had a lovely afternoon being a bird, that a golden eagle had invited her to fly with him over Spirit Mountain. They had soared and spun and floated, and now she was trying to sleep, but she was still an inch or so above her bed, spinning when she closed her eyes. And mother knew she hadn't started drinking. Dancers never drink.
You've been listening to episode 2 of The Ice Dancer by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings, if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband, Robert Ellis, on piano, from his CD titled Moonrise. We'll close today's episode with Homage to Ravel by Honegger.